Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Early voting kicks off today in Louisiana, and already there are reports of long lines stretching through parts of Metro New Orleans. This development complicates President Trump's claim at a town hall on NBC last night that vaccines are coming soon. And a new poll out from NBC and the Wall Street Journal shows that Trump's trailing Biden by double digits nationally. For more, let's bring in NPR's White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. And Aisha, let's talk about Biden's lead. This latest poll shows that Biden is leading 53-42%. What can voters take away from this, if anything?
It's not meaningless. Obviously, the presidency will be decided based on the Electoral College. But at a certain point, a lead of that substantial, if it were to bear out, would be difficult to overcome in the Electoral College. That's much higher than the percentage that Trump lost the popular vote by in 2016. But probably what is more concerning to the Trump campaign right now is the direction that the polls are going in, and they do not seem to be moving in his favor. It's the fact that Biden's lead, which has been consistent, is actually growing at this point, and you only have about 2 full weeks left. And so that's really more the direction that things are going. It's not tightening in Trump's favor. There is a debate next week, so that could give them a chance to try to get some more voters or to get some more people who will support him. But that's the issue. It's really the direction right now.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about what Biden's lead looks like. What's the picture looking like for him in some of these swing states like Arizona and North Carolina?
Yeah, it's much tighter. And so that's where you will have the Trump campaign saying that we feel like we do have a path. They also discount polls. But when you look at like the Real Clear Politics polling average, Biden is up just 2.7% in North Carolina and up 4% in Arizona. So you see these races, they're much tighter. They could be within the margin of error. And so you could those races, that's why this is still a race, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's why you, even with these large national leads, there you can see where the Trump campaign is going to look at and see where they could make up some ground. And so you're likely going to see them in Arizona, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan. You're going to see them in some of these swing states where they think that they can make a difference.
Well, Aisha, the other advantage, though, for the Biden campaign is cash. They just announced they raised a record-breaking $383 million in September, meaning they have $432 million in cash on hand. How does that compare to the Trump campaign?
So the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee, they've raised $248 million in September. So and that's still a lot of money, but it is definitely behind where the Biden campaign is. And there's just when it comes to that, this type of enthusiasm giving money, the Biden campaign and Democrats have had momentum there that the Trump campaign has not had. And it is unusual for an incumbent president to have to not be in the lead or to have this issue with raising money. Like I said, there's still a lot of money out there.
Right.
But it is the fact that you're seeing all of this momentum on Biden's side, that you're seeing all of this money coming in and flowing into their campaign. You know, Trump has said that he is willing, if they have a shortfall, that he's willing to spend some of his own money if necessary. As far as we know, that hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. Many Democrats running for Senate are also seeing huge influxes of cash. Where is all that money coming from? Is it more individuals or are PACs affecting that part of the race?
Well, you know, we're seeing a lot of, well, for Biden, they had $203 million come in from online donors, and the campaign said $1.1 million were new donors. So there has been this huge surge of online donations, and it's benefited because I think a lot of people, especially with Biden, he wasn't the most or seen as the most as the campaign with this huge grassroots army of supporters. But Democrats have had so much support, a lot of it based on opposition to President Trump, that you've seen this huge surge in online donors and making a huge difference in the campaign at this moment.
That's NPR's White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the dueling town halls last night featuring President Trump on NBC and Joe Biden on ABC have kept the chatter churning on social media. Let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, for a weekly look at how the news is playing out online. Hi, Femi.
Hello, Jeremy. I was exhausted switching channels every couple of seconds.
I know. Same here. Same here. And that doesn't even count some of the entertainment programming that was on last night. But how are people talking about the town halls on social media?
Well, they both started at the same time. And so they're being billed as dueling town halls. So the great thing about social media is when you were watching one, you could read the tweets about the other one and vice versa. Former RNC chairman Michael Still tweets it best. Folks, if you're not already doing this, do it. If you're watching one of these town halls, start flipping now. You won't believe what you're about to see, a contrast in style, substance, and presidential demeanor. He leaves it out there for you to decide which one you like the best. And let me just bring this quick review in from the President Trump from earlier on this morning. Very good reviews on last night's at NBC News town hall in Miami. Thank you. That is, of course, disputed. But there was one moment, Jeremy, and I believe you have it, where the President Trump got an unexpected compliment.
Yes, yes. It was actually kind of strange. And actually, the weird thing was that it came from somebody who was identified as somebody who was undecided but leaning towards Biden. This is Paulette Dale. Here she is.
Good evening, Mr. President.
Thank you very much.
I have to say, you have a great smile.
Gotcha.
So, he does. You're so handsome when you smile.
So, what are people saying about this, Femi?
Lots of visuals and emojis and memes. So just go and look up President Trump handsome and you'll find them for yourself. There was some analysis, though, about flattery actually helping and maybe leading to policy in a Trump administration. So the actual question was about DACA. And President Trump said, you're going to be very happy next year. So maybe that you're so handsome comment, maybe that might work out. I have to share this with you, though, from Bette Midler. She's always talking about President Trump. And it's just such a beautiful, beautiful tweet. I have to share it. Tonight, a woman in the audience at Trump's town hall began her question by telling him he has a great smile and he's so handsome when he smiles. And when hashtag Joe Biden is president, hopefully that woman will be able to access better vision care. Bless her heart. That is a Twitter burn and a half.
Oh, boy. Whenever you say bless her heart, you always know that there's something bad coming there. Let's listen to one of the moments people are talking about from Biden's town hall. This is an exchange he had with Cedric Humphrey, a student from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who is black.
Good evening, former Vice President Biden.
Good evening.
Many people believe that the true swing demographic in this election will be black voters under the age of 30. Not because they'll be voting for Trump, but because they won't vote at all. I myself have had this exact same conflict. So my question for you then is, besides you ain't black, what do you have to say to young black voters who see voting for you as further participation in a system that continually fails to protect them?
Well, I say, first of all, as my buddy John Lewis said, it's a sacred opportunity and right to vote. You can make a difference. If young black women and men vote, you can determine the outcome of this election. Not a joke. You can do that.
What are people saying about this exchange on social media?
A number of conservatives on Twitter really like this exchange. They felt that it made Joe Biden look bad. He put his foot in it a few months ago when he said, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. Harrison Floyd enthusiastically shared that clip that we just shared, Jeremy. And Harrison said, Cedric came in hot, hashtag black voices for Trump, hashtag woke, hashtag you ain't black. But then Cedric Humphrey himself is on Twitter and says, you must have missed the progressive Democrat part. And he says, delete your tweet, but not in quite as polite a way as I just said it.
Hmm. Femi, I have about a minute left, and I could talk about Tiffany Trump, but instead, we're going to just pass that by, and I will say, as this is my last day, it has been such a joy to work with you. Specifically. You and I have actually hosted this show. Have hosted this show together.
Don't leave,
We've gone out for drinks together. Listen,
you know more about social media than I do.
No, that's not true. Come on.
I analyzed your tweets this week. You tweeted 100 times and 26,000 people were influenced by your tweets. That's amazing, Jeremy.
100 times. Wow.
Yes,
that's amazing.
That much. Now you'll be able to tweet
Femi,
1,000 times.
Listen, you're still going to be here on Here and Now, and I know the listeners are going to be very happy about that. So thank you for everything. Femi Okay, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. It has been my pleasure and honor. This is Here and Now.
Political analysts have long predicted that Latinos could shift U.S. politics to the left, giving Democrats a clear advantage. Nationwide, Latinos are now the largest non-white voting bloc in this year's election. Latinos, however, are not a monolithic voting group. There's a long history of support for the GOP. For instance, in 2016, Trump won 28% of the Latino vote. For more on this, we're joined now by Geraldo Cadava, author of The Hispanic Republican and professor of history at Northwestern University. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
As I noted, the Latino vote has become nearly synonymous with the Democratic Party, but that's a recent change. In the 60s and 70s, there was actually a marked increase in Hispanic Republican voters. Why was that?
So, ever since 1972, Richard Nixon's reelection campaign, about a third of the Latino vote, a little less, a little more, has voted for the Republican president. And Richard Nixon was really the first Republican president to make a concerted effort to reach out to Latinos. It had to do with a lot of things. I would say that first, the Republican Party recognized that they were losing African-American voters and they needed to replace those lost votes, and Latinos were the prime targets. But Richard Nixon, coming from California, you know, claimed to have a background with Mexican-American communities southeast of Los Angeles, and he grew up near them, he said, and was familiar with them. And he made a commitment to recruiting several Latinos to move to Washington. They came from California. They headed his cabinet committee on opportunities for Spanish-speaking people. He appointed the first Hispanic treasurer of the United States. And he really brought Latinos into his administration, was the first one to do so. So patronage and appointments was really important.
So there was Nixon, but also Ronald Reagan that mobilized the Latino or Hispanic vote. And as you said, both of them are from California. Reagan was the state's former governor. And so even though popular thought is always characterizing it as this Latino base is predominantly anti-Castro Cubans in Florida, it sounds like the GOP base is actually Mexican and has been in California for a really long time. How did this particular thing come to be?
Yeah, that's right. You know, that was one of the biggest surprises to me when I did my research, and still everyone I talked to about my project said, oh, you must be writing a lot about the Cuban exile community. And one interview I did with a Mexican-American Republican who was in the Ford administration, actually, and canvassed for Nixon in his 68 and 72 campaigns, told me, you know, Cuban-Americans didn't really matter until the 1980s when Ronald Reagan brought them in. And that was a mystery to me at first, but then I realized that, you know, for much of the 60s, Cubans were still kind of focused on U.S.-Cuban relations and still focused on overthrowing Castro. And so Cubans didn't really start to naturalize in large numbers until the mid-1970s. And so Mexican-Americans, they're still today, I mean, the largest Hispanic population. So you can't really have like a Latino politics without in some way going through Mexican-Americans. And a group of kind of business-minded, Catholic Mexican immigrants, or the children of Mexican immigrants, came into the Republican Party in the mid-20th century, and they kind of grew the Hispanic Republican movement from California and Texas and other places in the Southwest.
When do we start to see this fissure between the GOP party and Latino voters? I imagine it's driven by the party's increased calls for a border wall and California Proposition 187, which prohibited undocumented immigrants from using non-emergency state services. Can you outline the beginning of the divide here?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly an important turning point. I would push it back maybe a decade and say, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, this is when you start to see the Republican Party going in two different directions. And on the one hand, several Republicans arguing for, you know, a big tent Republican Party that's inclusive of African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, Asian Americans, and others. And on the other hand, this kind of nativist wing of the party that's kind of best represented by folks like Pat Buchanan or the U.S. English movement, which has been trying to pass a constitutional amendment making English the official language of the United States. And this is when you have the Republican Party kind of moving in different directions. That's when Hispanic Republicans start to feel alienated from the Republican Party. But I think it's important to note that even as the Republican Party tacked right on immigration and border issues, by the 1990s, Hispanic Republicans had developed considerable loyalty to the party. And I think that partially explains why support for the Republican Party has been so durable, even though the party has shifted.
You brought up the Catholic factor. Yeah. And we have always heard this narrative that Latinos are more likely to lean conservative because of a significant population of Catholic folks. Mm-hmm. You've said there's no natural way for Latinos to vote, that people are not innately more Democrat or Republican. And yet both parties seem to utilize this line of thinking in their voter engagement efforts.
Yeah.
Can you say more on what that looks like and why do we do this?
Oh, boy. These are big questions and really get at the heart of the matter. I mean, both parties have argued that Latinos are natural Democrats or natural Republicans. I mean, they've, of course, done this to try to gain some partisan advantage. But I think what it ultimately does is, in some ways, take Latinos for granted. And part of why I wanted to write the book is to kind of portray Latinos, whatever their political background, as serious political actors with deeply held political beliefs that don't change just because someone calls them a natural Democrat or a natural Republican. I just think that it fundamentally underestimates their greatly diverse political beliefs. I think when people talk about Latinos not being a monolith, I think what they're talking about primarily is their Puerto Rican or Mexican American or Cuban national background. But I think that those national groupings, that's just the first thing you can say about the diversity among Latinos. I think they come from different class backgrounds. They come from different countries with different histories of immigration and relating to the United States. Some have light skin, some have dark skin. Some are religious, some are not. Some serve in the military, mm-hmm. some serve, you know, they're just greatly diverse. And there are ways of talking about the Latino vote in Texas or Arizona or Florida. But whenever you get down on the ground in those communities and start talking to people about their political beliefs, the picture just becomes so much less clear.
So as we move forward and Latino Hispanic voter power grows, what do you think parties need to do to make sure they represent this growing electorate?
I think the first thing to say is that they shouldn't come around to engaging Latino voters only in the weeks or a couple of months before an election. I think Latino political strategists, Latino voters have always been frustrated when candidates only first reach out to them after the political conventions or during Hispanic Heritage Month. There were reports this summer that, you know, more than half of Latinos reported having not been contacted by either campaign as late as July or August. But I think the most successful models for reaching out to Latinos, encouraging their support, developing their loyalty, comes when you establish relationships with them early and often, even when you're not looking for their votes.
That's Geraldo Cadava, author of The Hispanic Republican and professor of history at Northwestern University. Geraldo, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Latinos could be crucial in deciding swing states like Nevada, where former Vice President Biden leads by only 6 points and where 20% of the electorate is Latino. But as you heard Geraldo Cadava say, neither party has done a particularly good job reaching out to Latinos. Let's check in now with Maria Nieto Horta. She's the Nevada State Coordinator for Mi Familia Vota, an organization that goes door to door to get people registered to vote and learn about the issues. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Tanya. Thank you so much for inviting and for having me.
Absolutely. So you've been going door to door as well as to local grocery stores in predominantly Latino neighborhoods to inform people about the upcoming election and register them to vote. As you've done this, what have you found in terms of how motivated people are to vote and how prepared they are for this election?
Yeah, they definitely want answers. And like during the pandemic, people thought that we didn't have an election anymore because they didn't see us outside of grocery stores and like in Latino neighborhoods. It was definitely a difficult decision to make to return back to the field, but the community does need us, and I firmly believe that as long as we're practicing social distancing, as long as we're being careful, we can both be safe and healthy and also ensure that the Latinx community is educated on what is going to be happening, but also mobilized and empowered. I think that that's the biggest part is empowerment. If people feel like their vote doesn't matter, they feel like their activism doesn't matter, then they won't do it. They won't participate. And that will be like the biggest downfall.
This year, as you know all too well, it's been really difficult, especially in Las Vegas, where at one point during the pandemic, when the city shut down back in April, 1 in 3 people in the city were unemployed. I imagine this is a top issue for voters you are engaging with. But what are you hearing about the major issues impacting how they vote?
Unemployment is one of the biggest issues for sure. Definitely COVID. So like everything that has to do with health. If they get sick, like they're going to have to be unemployed, and everything just ties together. And that also playing a part, like immigration is also a huge aspect. Like immigrants don't feel comfortable just, you know, going to the doctor or asking for help. And I think that that is like the biggest thing in the Latinx community is we can't assume that the Latinx community just focuses on one issue when every issue crosses with each other.
Maria, you're also a DACA recipient, which gives you resident status, but it also means that you don't have the right to vote. Why do you still care so much about getting folks to vote and doing the work that you're doing?
Yeah, when the previous election happened, I was scared to get involved, but I was more worried to out myself as a DACA recipient, to out myself as someone that is undocumented. And it was in feeling empowered by myself, by my mentors, that I was like, you know, I can't vote, but I can still get people out to vote. I can still talk about my story. I can still talk about the way that politics affects me. I do care a lot about getting out the vote because I believe that everyone, regardless of socioeconomic status or legal status, like we all deserve someone who will look out for everybody that's currently in the country.
That's Maria Nieto Horta, the Nevada State Coordinator for Mi Familia Vota. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
The Commerce Department reported today that retail sales jumped 1.9% in September, the fifth straight monthly increase, and evidence of a surprising level of strength on the part of consumers. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And kind of surprising to hear that given the unemployment situation, and by the way, the fact that many stores and businesses are operating at a limited capacity because of the pandemic, that this is happening. What's going on?
Well, Jeremy, I think one of the really remarkable things that happened this year is that the savings rate for Americans went through the roof this year. And a big part of that, I suspect, is because of what they sometimes refer to as the experience economy. In other words, spending on stuff like cultural events or cooking classes or otherwise experiences rather than, say, shopping at the mall. And there's been a lot of studies and research that says this is an especially big source of spending for millennials and younger generations. Well, all of that spending basically vanished for much of this year when the country went into lockdown mode. So there was this immense amount of savings going on because money was not being spent on that sort of thing. And I think this far into the virus, people are stuck home and maybe they want to spend a few bucks and get some new furniture or upgrade their home office. And they do have that beefed up savings from a lack of opportunity to spend it elsewhere. And I think that's probably what's being reflected in these retail sales numbers.
Well, and what does that mean as we get into the holiday shopping season? And I know it seems early, but it's October 16th. We're almost there. What are people expecting with that?
Well, one thing is obviously there's been this shift from traditional brick and mortar retail to online. That's been going on for years, but the virus is really going to accelerate that trend this year, most likely. And one really notable stat I saw from the research firm Redbook that tracks retail sales is that there's a major shift going on from department stores to discount chains like a Walmart or a Costco. Redbook is projecting that sales at discounters will rise about 17% in October, whereas department stores, they're projecting sales will fall 29%. So a real dichotomy there in the sort of the places people are going to spend their money.
Speaking of a dichotomy, we got this news about retail sales going up, but it came a day after news that the number of people filing for unemployment benefits also went up last week to the highest number since late August. What does that tell you about the labor market right now? And what does it mean in terms of another stimulus relief package from Congress? Are they going to get anywhere before the election?
Right. It's still a very worrisome job market, Jeremy. I mean, we saw an unprecedented decline in employment, about 22 million jobs lost in March and April. We did see a huge bounce back as some stores and restaurants began reopening, but we're still about 10 million jobs below where we were before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So this is just a sign that this recovery is slow and ongoing. And it does sort of put more pressure on Congress to get together for this stimulus package. Fortunately, it doesn't sound like they're very near a deal just yet. Nancy Pelosi saying that there are still a lot of disagreements between the White House and the Democrats.
That is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The number of new daily COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has surged to levels not seen for months. And researchers at Columbia University write in the journal Science that COVID-19 could become endemic with potentially recurring outbreaks. One of the researchers is Jeffrey Shaman, professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia, who joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Well, you wrote this article with researcher Marta Galanti. Can you explain what that would look like for the coronavirus to become endemic?
Well, it's really an exploration of what the end game for this virus is. We've had other pandemic viruses emerge, particularly if we look at the influenza viruses, such as the one in 2009 and the one in 1918. And after they go through a pandemic phase, they don't disappear. They settle into a pattern of what's called endemicity, where they're recurrently infecting people. And they do this because they can repeatedly infect individuals, and they change over time, and they circulate around the globe. And so we were exploring some of the factors that are going to affect the ultimate pattern with which this new virus might enter endemicity, if it indeed does.
So does that mean that we would treat it like we would treat the flu, where maybe you get a flu shot every year if you are in a particular category, or because this virus is clearly so much more deadly than the flu that we would have to treat it differently?
You know, those are the unresolved questions, unfortunately. So we have a lot of uncertainty about how it's going to move forward. One could imagine a scenario where this virus becomes a wintertime virus, and we may have a vaccine that is partially effective. So it doesn't completely confer infection, and the virus shifts enough over time that people are still susceptible to it. One might hope that if we are subject to repeat infection and we don't have an effective vaccine that really protects us in an airtight way, that the virus would become less severe in its manifestations upon repeat infection generally. And that would be a good outcome, but it's only one of a number of possible outcomes. I mean, I can also paint a picture where we do have a very effective vaccine, and effectively this virus pretty much goes away.
Does it depend at all on what we do right now to prevent COVID-19 from being with us continually?
I'd have to say it depends very little. Right now, we really need to try to control the virus to minimize the harm it does to people. We don't have a lot of good options for keeping people well, other than typical standard of care, which is improving because we're getting a better understanding of how to manage patients. But we don't have a lot of pharmaceutical interventions readily at our disposal. Now, that may change in the coming months, but right now, we really just need to do all we can to prevent people from getting this infection and winding up in the hospital.
Do we still have a chance through mask wearing, social distancing, et cetera, to snuff the virus out?
I don't think we have a really strong chance of snuffing the virus out with just these non-pharmaceutical interventions. I think we have a very strong chance of controlling the virus. And again, if we were to look at some of the countries around the world that have managed to actually successfully control this virus, they do so, and they're actually then able to reopen their economies. And so they have the dual advantage of having a much more robust economy than some other places in the world, such as the U.S., and the control of the virus. And that's really the objective we should be shooting for in the immediate future.
But even in places that seem to have the virus under control, and I'm thinking especially of Europe, we're now seeing restrictions come back. Even in New York City, we're seeing restrictions come back in some places. What do you think is going to happen over the next, let's say, 6 months with this virus?
Well, you know, a couple things. Firstly, I wouldn't have characterized Europe as being one of those places where they really had it under control. I would characterize places like New Zealand and Vietnam and Thailand and Iceland and South Korea as places that have the virus much more successfully under control. But even they have to remain vigilant. And I think the warning that you see from the flare-ups you see in the countries I just named, as well as what's going on in Europe, which is a much more severe circumstance right now, is that you can't get complacent. And it really requires messaging and communication from the national leaders in each of these countries to try to motivate the population to stay vigilant and to continue the practices. Look, we're all tired of this virus, but the virus doesn't really care how exhausted we are by it. It's just going to do its thing. So it's really paramount that we stay vigilant. We're going into a very dangerous season potentially right now, where we have kids back in school, the weather is getting colder and people are spending more time indoors, and things like restaurants are opening up for indoor dining. You put all those things together and I just see lots of increased opportunity for the transmission of this virus.
Professor Shaman, I've already wrapped my head around the idea that Thanksgiving is going to be weird this year, that Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's, all going to be, you know, masked up and socially distanced. Do you think that by the time we get to next 4th of July, we're also going to be wearing masks and socially distant?
I think on that time scale, we could be coming to the backside of this. I'm not going to say that we're definitely going to, but I think we could be coming out of the pandemic phase with this virus. A lot will depend on what those vaccines actually offer, how effective some of the therapeutics that are being developed are. But I think on that time scale, which is about 8 months in the future, that we may have the distribution of some effective pharmaceutical agents that can actually help protect people and keep them safe if they are infected.
That is Jeffrey Shaman, professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure being here, Jeremy. Be well.
Well, now to some personal news. Today is my last day with Here and Now. This month marks 10 years since I started hosting a daily national program, and what a decade it has been. When I joined this team in 2013, I did so with one goal in mind, to grow this show into the morning edition, or all things considered, of the midday. Since then, we have tripled our audience to more than 5 million listeners like you, and we're broadcasting to almost every radio market in this country. I am so proud of all that we have achieved together. As the youngest person ever to host one of the major public radio shows, as well as the first openly gay host of a WBUR program, the team and I worked to ensure that Here and Now brought in new voices, younger voices, more diverse voices. We also wanted to make sure that we were a truly national show, covering the whole country and indeed the world. Well, any regular listener to Here and Now can attest that we are. We have broadcast this show from Concord, New Hampshire and Orlando, Florida, from Portland, Oregon and Nashville, Tennessee, from San Antonio, Texas, and Yellowstone National Park, right in front of Old Faithful, twice from London to cover Brexit with the help of our brilliant partners at the BBC, and once from Mexico City after President Trump was elected. On those trips, I've gotten to work with a number of terrific Here and Now producers who have bright futures ahead of them. Throughout my career, which started in public radio when I was 9 years old, working on a show for kids called Treehouse Radio in my hometown of Urbana, Illinois, I have learned from some of the best people in the business. And most importantly, I've gotten to meet and interact with public radio's amazing listeners. Smart, engaged citizens who want to pay attention to what's going on around them and who are willing to support independent journalism that they can trust, something that is more important now than ever. So back to me leaving the show. Since COVID-19, I, like many in our business, have been broadcasting from home, or you might say living at work. It's given me a different perspective, and after 21 years in the daily news business, I'm ready to take a little break from the here and now, if you will, and prepare for my next challenge. It's going to be sad, as you can hear, for me to leave my incredible coworkers who work so hard every day to bring important conversations to you. But I believe that public radio will continue to be a place where journalists will humbly seek the truth. It is what I have always tried to do with you, the listener, in mind. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for letting me join you each day. You can find me on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson, and I promise I'll let you know about my next project just as soon as I can.
HBO's Lovecraft Country concludes its first season this Sunday. The show focuses on a black family, the supernatural, the all-too-real horrors of Jim Crow America, and a lot more. And NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to discuss the show ahead of its finale. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
Okay, there is so much to unpack in this show. It's based on a novel. The title references horror fiction writer H.P. Lovecraft. Tell us more about the premise of this show.
Do we have 2 hours? Can I take up the whole show?
I know.
It's just jam-packed with stuff. I mean, so as the series begins, we are introduced to Atticus Freeman. He's a veteran of the Korean War. He's coming back to his hometown in Chicago, and his father has disappeared. And it turns out his disappearance is wrapped up in magic. And so the show kind of takes all of these horror and supernatural tropes, many of which were created by H.P. Lovecraft, and puts a black family at the center of them. And that is such a twist because Lovecraft was notoriously in real life a racist. Mm-hmm. There's this constant back and forth where you're introduced to these real life instances of racism, things like sundown towns where black people were not allowed to be within the city limits after the sun went down, lynchings, Emmett Till's death. All these things are sort of recast and made part of the family's lore because they're connected to magic, and the family is trying to save itself from these malevolent white people who use dark magic to advance themselves.
Yeah. There's a haunted house episode, a body horror episode, a time travel episode. As you said, it takes on a lot of different things. I mean, so many different concepts. Do you think that overall it pulls off that huge range of ideas it's playing with?
It feels like the people who made this thought that they might only get one shot at it. So they just stuck everything. they stuck everything in this series that they could possibly think of. You know, one of the things that's interesting, for example, it interrogates all the rigid roles that black men and women have had to face, again, in 1950s Jim Crow era America. And there's a character, Hippolyta, who, as you mentioned, discovers a time travel machine and eventually travels in time. And she talks a little bit about how discovering this was freeing for her. And we have a clip. Let's check it out.
Now that I'm tasting it, freedom. Like I've never known before. I see what I was robbed of back there. All those years I thought I had everything I ever wanted, only to come here and discover that all I ever was the exact kind of Negro woman white folks wanted me to be. I feel like they just found a smart way to lynch me without me noticing the noose.
And in the way in which that character is escaping the rigid bonds of her life, the show itself is doing the same thing. It is taking these black characters and freeing them from the roles that they are often placed in these kinds of stories. There's just so much packed into this series.
Okay, it seems for those who have watched the show that they fall into two camps. They are part of the cult of Lovecraft Country. They just absolutely love it and want to talk about it. And then those who find it to be super traumatic, because we're talking about racism, there's sci-fi elements, and then it's also an action film with lots of violence. What have you heard? I mean, it's obviously a very popular show.
Yeah, well, it's a show that is very bold, and it's pushing a lot of buttons. Hmm. The creator and showrunner, Misha Green, wound up posting an apology because they had a character that was an indigenous character that kind of got killed off in almost an offhanded way. And she wound up apologizing for not doing more with that character and finding a way for that character's arc to be less stereotypical. So even the showrunner has admitted that there's some times when maybe they got it wrong or they could have handled it better.
And Eric, without spoiling it, you had a chance to see the season finale, which will air on Sunday. Do you think it's a fitting end to the season?
Well, you know, as with a story this complex, I'm sure there's some people who might be disappointed. The story has come down to the family coming together to try to save Atticus's young cousin who's been cursed. And so there's a moment where Atticus sort of falls into a trance and he reconnects with his ancestor who's been helping him learn how to use magic. Let's play that clip.
I realized this magic was not something to be feared, but a gift to pass on.
I need your help. My cousin's been cursed. I unbound a book to save him.
You gonna save them all?
So I think people who love the series will find this conclusion to be everything that they hoped it would be. And if there are things about the series that have troubled you, the finale's not going to change that.
Well, a lot of folks will be looking forward to Sunday. I want clarification from you. Will there be a season two of Lovecraft Country?
You know, I was asking the folks at HBO that very question. There hasn't been an announcement. I would be surprised if HBO didn't do another season, but we haven't heard anything definitive yet.
That's NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.